From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Oscar Wilde, the famous, celebrated, and legendary writer and playwright known for such books as The Importance of Being Earnest and The Picture of Dorian Gray, was, by today's standards, Antifa. The philosophical depth and political radicalism of Oscar Wilde's ideas were in line with anarchist ideals and are hugely relevant to today's culture wars. My guest is Christian Williams. He is the author of several books, including Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and Between the Bullet and the Lie, Essays on Orwell. His latest book, with a foreword from the well-known comic writer Alan Moore, is called Resist Everything Except Temptation, The Anarchist Philosophy of Oscar Wilde. Welcome to the program, Christian.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
So for those who are only sort of vaguely familiar with Oscar Wilde, I imagine that they think of him as a rebel, this gay icon who flaunted the norms of the day, who pushed aside puritanical ideals, but he had politics, he had political views. How would you describe what those views are? And, you know, what? How did he express them outside of his most famous works of fiction?
Well, the argument I make in the book is that the best way of understanding Wilde's politics is in terms of the anarchism of his day. And I position his writing, and in particular his political writing, within the anarchist tradition, looking at both the anarchist influences in his thinking, and then the influence that his work had in later anarchist thought. And then I begin with an examination of his most famous political work, that being The Soul of Man Under Socialism, and then work outward into things that are not so obviously political, including things like The Picture of Dorian Gray, and even The Importance of Being Earnest, which on its face is just a long exercise in silliness, but I think that it's a very serious kind of
story. So we should even step back, because this is an issue that is quite relevant today. I mentioned the word Antifa. It's a very loaded word. Of course, it just means anti-fascist, but it's lined with the sort of black-clad anarchist types that mainstream media, corporate media, conservatives very much like to symbolize anarchism or personify anarchism as. How do you just explain anarchism to an American audience, or a lay audience today?
I believe that anarchism begins with the precept that decisions should be made by the people most affected by them. And so that means that society should be structured in a relatively non-hierarchical manner that maximizes individual freedom and is based on equality in social relationships. So in practice, what that would mean is, rather than workplaces being organized according to as these kinds of dictatorships where the person who owns the place determines everything, instead the workplaces should be collectively managed by the people who work there, and in fact collectively owned by the people who work there. Similarly, rather than neighborhood life being governed by anonymous bureaucrats in some planning office, people who live in the neighborhood should make decisions about how things in their neighborhood are set up. In principle, I think it's a very simple doctrine, but working out in practice exactly how that means that power gets shared and power gets exercised can be pretty complicated.
Within that definition, how does Oscar Wilde fit?
Well, in his most famous political work, The Soul of Man Under Socialism, he makes this argument that
Of Man Under Socialism. This was an essay that he wrote that's not as well known, of course, as his works of fiction.
He argues that the purpose of socialism is that it will make individualism possible, that it will make it available for people to sort of live their most full lives, develop what they'll be freed from the burden of having to scramble in the capitalist economy and really sort of work for other people. He makes it clear in that essay that what he has in mind is not any sort of authoritarian kind of socialism, but instead a sort of voluntary arrangement between everybody in the community that in which they share resources and make decisions together. So although he doesn't use the word anarchism in that essay, it's clear that what he has in mind is much more in line with what anarchists at the time like, for example, Wiles friend Peter Kropotkin were writing about, than it would be for the sort of authoritarian and bureaucratic version of socialism that became dominant in the 20th century.
So he was born into aristocracy, right? Which one might, you know, imagine could be held against him. But how did he square his own, the circumstances of his own birth with his politics?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that he ever felt like he needed to apologize for his background. But that was not unimportant either in his development. In particular, because though he was part of the aristocracy, he was also part of the Irish aristocracy. And at a time when the Irish independence movement was at a particularly militant clip, and in fact, his mother was very involved in the Young Ireland movement a generation earlier. So he developed out of the milieu of Irish nationalism. And I argue in the book, from that principle of feeling like Ireland shouldn't be ruled by England, eventually evolved his thinking to the point that no one should be ruled by anyone. The principle of autonomy that informed his early nationalism eventually became universalized as a principle of anarchism.
When we talk about the fiction work in particular, I want to pick up on what you were saying earlier with some of his fiction works around, especially the importance of being earnest. How do his philosophies manifest themselves? What were some of the ways in which he saw the social order needing to change?
Well, in the fiction and in the plays in particular, they're mostly remembered as these sorts of just aesthetic exercises. And I think that they seem to be more interested in sort of the free play of language and the beauty of the presentation rather than questions of character or plot or message or anything like that. In fact, he would argue in his critical work that the aesthetic should predominate and that art should be something other than just a way of delivering sermons. But there's a kind of politics even implicit in that aesthetic approach, in that it eschews the sort of utilitarian and the sort of practical aspects of the capitalist notion that everything to be justified has to be useful. Instead, it implies that there are things that can be good without serving some greater purpose, that just the mere beauty of it is, in fact, enough.
Which is that very said, much sort of in opposed to how our economies are organized today, the consumerism of the American economy, viewing people as resources, right?
Yes, it's in total contradiction to the market thinking, and also belatedly in opposition to the sort of Victorian moralism that was predominant at the time, the idea that any work of art, any sort of piece of culture, that its ultimate purpose should be to instill moral values in the reader. Wilde was way more interested in the pleasure it could give to the reader rather than an effort to like reform his audience's character. All that said, there are also, if you pay attention to the content of the society plays, and if you pay attention to the content of the fiction, there often is a overt political element. I mean, many of the society plays turn on questions of sexual propriety. They turn on questions of social status and the way that people compromise themselves in order to gain status, and even the importance of being earnest, which, you know, on its surface just seems like this kind of volley of witticisms. The plot turns on this question of having a good name, and built into that are questions of the legitimacy of children, the way that status gets relayed from one generation to the next, and in particular also questions of gender and relations between the sexes. All of that is easy to miss because it's so funny, but the reason it's so funny is because he's subverting the norms of his time. The fact that it remains funny more than 100 years later is pretty remarkable.
How did he view the use of violence as a political tool? Today, anarchism is unfortunately deeply linked to violence by its detractors.
Yeah, this is a complicated question, and he had different thoughts on it in different moments. On the one hand, he said that, I mean, one of the few occasions in which he used the term anarchism, he said that we are all socialists nowadays, but so I must be something more. I think perhaps I'm an anarchist. And then he immediately went on to say, but of course the dynamite policy is absurd. The dynamite policy being a sort of shorthand for what was called propaganda by the deed, which was the idea that a program of terrorism and assassinations could show the vulnerability of the government and inspire masses to rise up. That it never worked out that way. So in terms of success, he was definitely right that it was absurd. That said, he had a great deal of sympathy for people who engaged in those sorts of tactics. And he also had a great deal of sympathy for, you know, sort of riotous street demonstrations and that sort of thing. And he explicitly defends them in the Soul of Manner of Socialism.
And was there a debate at that time around property destruction versus harming humans like there is today?
To the degree that there was a debate, it was sort of a nascent version of the same thing that we have. I mean, the people who rule society were very inclined to see the destruction of their property as being equivalent to acts of warfare. And in fact, there was little distinction between made in the eyes of the authorities between what would we would consider just sort of a normal demonstration and what they would consider a riot. And if you read the literature of the time, it's very common to see normal sort of strike activity of just workers walking out of the job described by the police as a riot. So the standard of order was very high, and anything that disrupted that was sort of automatically put in this category of sort of riotous unrest.
So when we examine Oscar Wilde's writings today, do you think it's apparent to contemporary readers that he had these political sensibilities built into, especially some of his famous fiction writings? Or is this something that, someone paying attention to our so-called culture wars today would be able to discern?
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely there. And I argue in the book that if we pay attention to, if we take what he writes seriously, the politics become very evident. On the other hand, I did write a 200-page book sort of excavating what the politics are. So I think there's a little bit of work to be done in terms of bringing it to the forefront. He wasn't someone like Dickens. He wasn't like a message writer. But nevertheless, the politics definitely find their way in the work and I think animate a lot of what makes the work interesting. On the other hand, some of what he does is very subtle and depends on some understanding of the context in which he was writing. So if you're familiar with the debates and anxieties that were characterizing Victorian society, at the time, his politics would have been much clearer. And in fact, he was often attacked for them.
Right. So the way in which Oscar Wilde is viewed today is very different from the way in which he was viewed by his contemporary peers, which is, of course, often the case for people with radical politics. So you think of, not to compare Wilde to, say, Dr. King, but just as an example, we see Dr. Martin Luther King, who was much more radical during his time and vilified by his critics, today is seen in a much more romanticized light. And we certainly have that with a lot of other folks who have political leanings that are quite strong, and those political leanings either get pushed to the back or are just not seen as that radical years after their deaths. What about Oscar Wilde's sexuality and sexual orientation? How did that inform his politics? And he was certainly very open about not wanting to live by the norms of Victorian society.
Yeah, I think finding himself as an outsider in terms of his sexuality did a lot to both muster his sympathy with other sorts of outsiders and also informed his attack on the Victorian moralism, on the sexual politics of the time. Interestingly, the aestheticism that we were talking about earlier, and that idea that beauty is its own justification, it doesn't have to be marketable, it doesn't have to be useful, was in the milieu in which he was operating also very tied up with these questions of sexuality. And the sort of Oxford aesthetes from which he came were more than usually sort of infused with a homosexual tendency. His sexuality played a very complicated role in his life overall, but it definitely did a lot to force his thinking outside of conventional frameworks. And I think did definitely inspire a lot of his political trajectory.
And so when we look at the relevance of Oscar Wilde today, as you see the political situation around us, the rebellion on the streets of the United States, the rise of fascism in the US, how would you characterize the relevance of Oscar Wilde's writings? Do you see them as having not just relevance, but even particularly a educational value or a source of inspiration?
Inspiration for sure. And I think that as much time as separates our moment from the moment that he was writing, it's strange and sad how much the Victorian mindset has continued even a century later and even in the United States. And so I think Wilde provides a kind of antidote to a lot of our implicit moralism. I think his view about the beauty of life and beauty being a value in itself can help us to correct for the kind of market thinking and the utilitarianism that often ends up dictating so much of our lives. And I think also it helps to look back and for us to remember that socialism or anarchism or whatever it is we want to call it used to be about this idea that life could be beautiful and free, and that it was about something more than sort of the petty factional fights and the street fighting and the sort of, it's easy, I think, to get lost in the grit of the day to day and forget the vision of the better world that we're looking for.
It's an
And I
idealism.
think just remember that. Yes, exactly.
And that is that sort of aspirational aspect of socialism seems to be in a bit of a revival or enjoying a bit of a revival today.
I sure hope so.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Christian, for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Christian Williams. He's the author of several books, including Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and Between the Bullet and the Lie, Essays on Orwell. His latest book, with a foreword from the well-known comic writer Alan Moore, is called Resist Everything Except Temptation: The Anarchist Philosophy of Oscar Wilde. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingup@sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.